Good morning, everybody, and welcome to this Flint briefing call. I'm Simon Fraser, Managing Partner at Flint, and I'm joined today by Sir Lawrence Freedman, who is the Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, and one of the leading commentators on the war in Ukraine. And he's our guest speaker. Welcome to you, Laurie. By Flint specialist partner, Sir Julian King, who was the UK's EU commissioner between 2016 and 2019. And Flint partner, Sam Lowe, who is our expert in UK and European trade policy. In the call today, we're going to look at the situation in Ukraine almost a year after the outbreak of the war in February 2022. As well as the destruction and suffering on the ground, of course, the war has brought structural changes to the world economy and to the international security and political order. And these changes we are really yet fully to understand the full extent of. More important, perhaps, we're going to be discussing what we can expect in the year ahead in 2023. It seems we're about to enter a new phase of the conflict, with both Russian and Ukrainian forces preparing for major offensives in the next few weeks. So we're going to discuss what's at stake and the various scenarios from escalation to negotiation, and then look at the broader consequences for geopolitics, for economic activity, and for trade. As usual on these calls, the lines are muted and we won't take questions during the call, but do let us know if there's anything you would like to discuss afterwards. The call itself will last for a maximum of 30 minutes. So let's get going. Laurie, I'm going to turn to you first, if I may. Next week marks a year since the invasion. So could you give us an assessment of the military position? After months of stalemate, it seems that the situation on the ground may be about to shift again. Are you expecting new offensives? And if so, how likely are they to change the military balance?
Thanks, Simon. It's a very puzzling situation at the moment. We are expecting new offensives. Indeed, the Russian offensive is widely believed to have started. The Ukrainian offensive, we know, will take some time before they can really get going. They're waiting for new equipment from the West. It has to be delivered. They have to train on it, prepare for and put together new formations to manage an offensive. So it's understood that the Russians are keen to get their offensive in first. But it's a suboptimal time for them. The weather isn't right. It's cold this week, but it can be boggy again next week. Nobody can quite see where they get their maneuver capabilities from because they used a lot of those up in a year ago. And they've largely been relying in all their advances since that first few weeks on artillery barrages plus infantry assaults. And these infantry assaults have become progressively more wasteful in recent months. So the Russian tactic at the moment seems to be to push forward wherever they can. At the very least, they're holding Ukrainian forces in position. The Ukrainians for the moment seem quite content to absorb what they can of what the Russians are doing because they're not actually moving very far. So although the Russians and the Ukrainians are talking loudly about this new Russian offensive, most experts are struggling to see quite how it can succeed. At the moment, it seems that in addition to one brick wall, which they've made some dents in Bakhmut, they're just adding some more brick walls against which they're throwing what are effectively expendable troops. So it's a curious situation, and one assumes that when this has gone about as far as the Russians can take it, the Ukrainians will then be in a position to move themselves. Whether the Ukrainians then can make a difference, we'll have to see, because so far the defense generally has been stronger in this war than offense. It's easier to defend than attack, and the Ukrainians are the ones who need to take territory back.
Okay, thank you very much. So that suggests that you're expecting the sort of attritional war to continue. I read some reports recently of a build-up of Russian air capabilities behind the border, which it may be worth just touching on also. But let's just look ahead then. Whether or not these offensives happen, one of the big questions now is going to be about how NATO calibrates its support to Ukraine. Do you think we are now seeing a choice emerging for Western countries about whether they move towards allowing Ukraine to go beyond defending itself, the point you made, to perhaps being developing a stronger offensive capability to win the war? Is the West prepared to do that? Is it capable of doing that? I saw reports today about the rapid consumption of ammunition on the Ukrainian side. What's the Western strategy, Laurie?
I think the West has made the choice. I think they've come to the conclusion that you're not going to get a negotiation until Russia really thinks it's losing significant ground, possibly even Crimea, though I think that's some distance away. So that choice has been made. It's evident in the supply of main battle tanks and in infantry fighting vehicles, in longer range missiles and artillery. All of these things indicate that choice has been made. You raised two other issues, one which is an important issue both in the short and the medium and the long term, which is just the sheer supply of ammunition, in which actually new systems help, because you've got you're not just relying on ammunition for established systems. But that's an issue. That's a big and worrying one for the Ukraine. It's a bit for the Russians as well. An air power, which has been another one of the puzzles of this war, which is one would have expected Russian air power to make much more of a dent. Their problem is that they have struggled with the air defense systems available to the Ukrainians. And if you're going to provide close air support to your land forces, then you have to fly quite low altitudes and you become even more vulnerable. It's not that the aircraft haven't been involved up to now, but just not en masse. And I think whether they can shift that will be quite important, but so far there's no indication that they can. Back to you, Simon.
Okay, thanks. So just a very brief footnote on that. I mean, do you think a negotiated settlement is a realistic prospect this year, or is that completely out of the question?
I think the best we can hope for is a ceasefire, possibly disengagement agreement. When you look at all the issues that would have to be negotiated, reparations, war crimes, agreeing forever a border, easing of sanctions, all that will take forever, take ages. But a ceasefire and possible disengagement, I suspect, is the best we can hope for, which would be significant, but you're looking more at a sort of North Korea situation possibly for the future than a Northern Ireland.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll come back to that at the end of the call. But I'll move on now, if I may, to talk to Julian. Julian, let's zoom out a little bit on this. There's no doubt that this war has shaken the international system over the last year. One feature of that was quite a lot of countries sort of sitting on the fence and declining to take sides in this conflict. Another feature, I'd say, was that the West turned out to be remarkably united in its position on Ukraine, as Laurie has mentioned. Are we, in your view, seeing the reshaping in the long term of alliances and blocs from this evolving situation in Ukraine? And what do you think about the roles of China and India, for example, in relation to Russia? And is Western unity going to hold together?
Well, good morning, Simon. Starting with your last point, Western unity has been notable. I think it surprised Putin. We probably surprised ourselves. And as we've just been discussing, there's going to continue to be sometimes heated discussions about what weapon systems to provide and how best to supply them. But outside of one or two outlier countries like Orbán's Hungary, given the strong popular support for Ukraine that continues to hold, it's pretty unlikely that anyone will significantly break ranks over providing that kind of equipment support. At least, I would say, this side of the NATO summit in the summer. And actually what's decided there at the NATO summit, including on the next Secretary General, I think is going to be an important indicator of levels of support for the second half of the year. That's not to say the West's united on all the downstream consequences of Ukraine, whether that's energy or trade or industrial policy consequences, or how to manage eventual reconstruction, which is going to cost a fortune. But those differences on those downstream issues, at least for the moment, I think is serving to strengthen cooperation on core military support. The West's also feeling, I think, a bit more confident than a few months ago about maintaining wider support, or at least limiting the loss of support more widely. They believe they've largely effectively countered the Russian narrative about the problems over the cost of food or access to fertilizer were the fault of the West. They believe support for Ukraine in the UN has stabilized. They don't expect more countries to drift into abstention. But it'll be interesting to see what happens in the UN votes that are coming up in the coming weeks. Does support drop below the 140 threshold, which has been established so far? And of course, that still leaves a lot of countries, about half the world's population, sitting on the fence, as you say. There's lots been written about the so-called Global South, seeing this as a sort of Western war, not their fight. China continues to plot a sort of careful course. They have lent Russia political support, but they're very wary of getting drawn further in, especially if that raises the chance of secondary sanctions. Other key countries, Brazil, South Africa, India, you mentioned, don't want to choose sides. They want a return to a more multipolar world where their voices count and they have more room for maneuver. They don't want to see Russia significantly weakened. India, for example, has benefited over the years from tensions between the US and Russia. It can't play the US and China off in the same way, given India's tensions with China. South Africa is preparing joint military exercises at the moment with Russia and China. Brazil is saying it could somehow mediate on Ukraine. So how India manages the G20 later this year, I think, will be key. It'll give us a better idea whether a new form of non-alignment is emerging, going beyond Ukraine and reactions to Ukraine, and whether it might influence wider issues around trade, investment, climate, and tech. Simon.
Okay, thank you for that overview. And let's pick up on the last point that you mentioned there, which is the economic side of it. And here I will turn to Sam, if I may. Let's look at that then, the economic and business consequences. Obviously, energy sanctions have brought significant structural change, certainly in the European economy. But how badly has Russia been affected by sanctions? And Western economies, if they do narrowly avoid recession this year, are still facing considerable difficulties with debt and interest rates and so forth. So what does another year of war mean for the European and wider world economy and global trade? Sam.
Thank you, Simon. In this discussion as to whether Western sanctions have been effective in respect of Russia is quite contested, in that you have some people who really focus on Russia's large current account surplus and the fact that it's clearly still able to sell to the rest of the world and make money. And then you have others, and I'd put myself in this camp, who are slightly more interested in whether Russia is able to actually obtain the things that we're trying to stop it from obtaining. But we are starting to get a broader sense of what the last year has looked like for the Russian economy. And year on year, so November to November, and the December statistics are hard to get hold of, but expected to be quite bad. Russian real GDP is down by about 4%, retail sales down by about 10%, wholesale trade turnover closer to minus 20%. And there's been a complete collapse in Russian domestic vehicle manufacturing. In terms of the trade data, in terms of exports to Russia, December to December, exports to Russia from Japan, Taiwan, South Korea have stabilized at notably lower levels. But on the other side of this, we've seen an uptick in exports from Turkey, China, Kazakhstan. And this suggests a degree of import substitution on the Russian side and possible sanctions circumvention. And while it hasn't grabbed the headlines, the circumvention fears combined with some evidence of products being diverted to the Russian war effort via other routes, has already led to a Europe-wide tightening of applied export control regimes vis-a-vis dual-use goods sales globally. And my expectation is there's going to be more of this over the coming year as Russia finds new ways to evade sanctions and get hold of the technologies it needs to sustain its war effort. And as an interesting aside, some researchers at the end of last year from St. Gallen University found that as of November 2022, only 8.5% of EU and G7 companies with an equity stake in Russia had actually divested at least one of their subsidiaries. And if the war continues, this is certainly an area that could come under further scrutiny as companies who have said they're going to leave are asked, well, have you actually? In terms of the European economy, I mean, look at the news. The economy's bad, but the general sense is it could have been worse. We benefited from a relatively warmer winter than expected. And to draw out a couple of points on energy and agri-food for the coming year, in the short term, Europe is likely to be able to rely on foreign energy resources to maintain its security of supply. This will be done through opening up additional supplies of gas, particularly LNG from suppliers other than Russia, mainly the US and Qatar. And this comes with a very big caveat. If energy demand, production and imports remain unchanged in 2023, net withdrawals from storage could compensate for the reduction in pipeline imports from Russia. The big caveat there is this assumption that energy demand, production and imports remain unchanged, and that should be registered. In terms of new LNG supplies, there's projects in Norway, Malaysia, US, Trinidad, and potentially Nigeria if technical issues were to be resolved. And of course, there's always the possibility of additional LNG deals with other third countries. On the food front, and this slightly depends on what happens with the Russian offensive, but it could put further pressure on food prices if it leads to additional disruption of Ukrainian agri-food production. I think a key moment to look for in the coming months is whether the agreement reached between Russia, Ukraine, and Turkey in the UN in July 2022 to allow food exports through the Black Sea will be retained, because it's due to expire at the end of March, and there is some uncertainty over Russia's willingness to extend its participation. If Russia were to withdraw, that could mean grain exports from Ukraine face additional difficulties with political consequences for African and Middle East countries in particular. And I'll hand back to you, Simon.
Okay, thank you for that. So obviously some important issues to keep an eye on the economic, energy and trade side. Laurie, can I come back to you as we sort of draw towards the end of the conversation? And Julian, I may bring you in on this as well. But I wanted to sort of conclude with a couple of questions, Laurie, for you, if I may. So first, if you can get your crystal ball out, please. I mean, what will the position be in Ukraine and Russia at the end of 2023? Is it going to be stalemate? We haven't talked much about the risk of significant escalation, actually. We've touched on the possibility of negotiation, which you don't seem to think is a central scenario. But where do you think we'll be at the end of this year? And secondly, another bigger picture question, really. How much does this really matter? And how dangerous is it really? Isn't China-US by far a bigger issue for world peace and economic progress, particularly as we gear up to a contested US presidential election in 2024. Could you give us a view on those things?
Sure. So on the first set of questions, I think it's going to be very difficult for both sides to sustain war at this intensity for another year. I just don't think they can do it. It's mean to say it can't carry on sputtering along. But I think the reason why you see both sides preparing or engaging in offensives is because they don't want it to last that much longer. Secondly, and this is relevant to the escalation point, Russia has escalated. In the big shift in Russian strategy in September was mass mobilization, which kept the war going. They would have struggled just on manpower reasons alone without the mobilization, but that has made a difference to their options. And secondly, the attacks on Ukrainian critical infrastructure, which has been in some ways one of the most efficient aspects of the Russian campaign, but it hasn't produced the political results they want. I think it's again one of the features of this, that the Russian strategy for enormous effort has yielded very little over the last 11 months, one can say. And I think that's so I don't think the nuclear side is something something that's going to worry us, obviously, but nuclear weapons already play a role. The reason why NATO isn't fighting side by side by Ukraine, the reason why Russia isn't attacking NATO countries. It's contained the conflict. I don't think it serves any purpose for Putin to except to occasionally insert it into the Western debate that it's a possibility and make us nervous. I don't think it's a serious option for him. The point about how does this compare with the other big issues? If Russia had succeeded, this would have been massive. If the scenario many people expected for late February last year, in which Russia was moving towards borders, the Polish border, and occupying a sovereign state, and feeling very cocksure about its capabilities, this would have had enormous implications for European security. What's happened is that NATO has held together, Ukraine has shown extraordinary resilience and resistance, and Russia has been much diminished. Whatever happens now, it's just not going to be the power it thought it was a year ago. So in that sense, sure, it will make it easier to think about other issues like China and so on coming up. But even with China, as Julian's already mentioned, the Chinese themselves have got to do some hard thinking about what it means to set oneself up as a diehard opponent of the West when your main ally is Russia, which seems to be strategically incompetent and not the strong partner you thought it might be.
Thank you. Julian, do you want to come in very briefly on any of that? Of course, one thing we haven't discussed, but it's a huge question which is not being sufficiently asked, in my view, is, you know, what is the longer-term implications of all this for Russia and the future of Russia? Maybe we can't cover that today, but is there any other point that you wanted to chip in on the bigger picture, Julian?
Well, perhaps one, that everything that we've been talking about, what happens in the rest of this year, is going to echo, obviously, beyond that, and is going to influence some of the big elections and political change elsewhere that is going to be taking place in 2024. There's obviously the US presidentials, but there's a lot of change in Europe as well, with European parliamentary elections and a new commission. And indeed, at least in principle, I think there's presidential elections slated in Russia and Ukraine. So all of the events we've been talking about this year are going to have an impact on political change next year and beyond.
Okay, thank you. I sort of agree. My personal view is that geopolitics in 2023 is going to be increasingly shaped by the US presidential election. The room for maneuver in Washington on some of these big questions is going to be constrained in the months ahead. Let's draw this to a close now. Thank you. A very interesting exchange. And Laurie, thank you very much for joining us. I think we can conclude that this war is far from over. It's likely to rumble on through this year. Laurie is not expecting major escalation, but nor is he expecting a very significant sort of peace initiative, a possibility of a ceasefire. But it looks like we are facing ongoing attritional warfare. And that means more uncertainty over the outcome and, of course, ongoing political and economic disruption for those of us who are economic and business actors. All of this is, of course, important to business, and there could be more surprises over the year ahead. So I don't think we can consider Ukraine now as just part of a sort of stabilized international context for activity. I think we have to continue to monitor events carefully, and of course there could be surprises along the way. We will continue to be doing that here at Flint, and if anybody wants to talk to us further about any aspect of this, our geopolitics team are very happy to do that. Thank you, meanwhile, for joining this call, everybody who has, and particular thanks to Laurie for joining us as our guest speaker, as well as to Julian and Sam. Goodbye, everybody, and have a good day.